Hello, everyone, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Odds and End podcast, where we look at important events and how likely they are. And I have my friend Scott Eastman here. Scott is a forecaster for the Swiss Center and also a super forecaster. And generally, that means that when he disagrees with me, I change my mind to his opinion. Scott has many areas of expertise, but he's very good on Ukraine. So I felt like it would be good to talk and ask him some questions. How are you doing this morning, Scott?
Doing well.
I'm glad to hear it. I enjoy that you're like, I mean, I can hardly think of a more quintessentially super forecaster place. I don't know if you're listening on this audio. Yeah. Scott is like, I don't know where you are in your house, Scott, but it definitely looks like somewhere you could like hustle down and forecast in, you know?
Yeah, I actually forecast in my attic on purpose because I found that just simply a set of stairs keeps most people away if I want some quiet time. I have an office downstairs, but somehow proximity makes people more likely to interrupt. So yeah, but it looks like I'm in some sort of cabin bunker. I don't know. So yeah.
Great. Okay. I don't know. Let's just go into it, and then we can. And also for anyone who's watching, this is a new format. But I'm going to try and sort of build a model of the things that Scott says while he says them, and that may be beyond me. But we'll see. I think there's like an interesting thing here. This is like a model building application we've got here. So I guess an interesting one for me is maybe something like it seems. You know, what do you think is? Yeah, let's go Tokmak first. Like, how likely do you think is that the Ukraine? Maybe you can tell us where Tokmak is. Mm-hmm. But how likely is you think the Ukrainian army is going to take Tokmak by the end of the year?
First of all, you have to tell me what Tokmak is.
Oh, great. So Tokmak is a city just to the north of Mariupol.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. So yeah, so here's one of the questions that we have is there's more than one route that Ukraine can take to get down to Crimea. And what we basically think is really important is not necessarily the specific city, but Tokmak definitely is important and it would be a natural route. But they can cut the land bridge from Russia to Crimea, either by going down to Melitopol and on down, going more Mariupol, or anywhere in between. It's like basically anywhere along the route they can try to draw a line. Now, there's obviously natural lines because you can say wherever there's major highways, roads, which Tokmak, can work. The most direct route is actually to would be to go just straight down from Zaporizhia through Melitopol, and that's sort of the shortest possible route to cut off Crimea. But it doesn't mean it's the route they're going to take because they need to look at defenses. They also need to have element of surprise. And so it's not always the shortest point or the most obvious point that will end up becoming the answer. You know, so if I look at something like taking Tokmak, I have to think of a few things. You know, one would be, is it an objective to get that far down? And I would say absolutely yes. It's really essential. Will they go, is it like a guarantee that they would have to go through that city? And I don't think the answer is yes on that.
Okay, so let's try and to drill down on a couple of those things. So mm-hmm. Which options do you think they have for directions that they might go this year, and how likely do you think those different options are?
Right. So the main thing I think that the main goal this year is to completely cut off Crimea from a land bridge, from Russia. And mm-hmm. and that serves two purposes. It serves the purpose of not being able to, not being able to resupply Crimea from Russia, not being able to resupply the rest of Ukraine, their forces in Ukraine through Crimea, because it can obviously send things currently through the Kerch Strait bridge, potentially through the Black Sea, but that's not very effective, to Crimea and on up. And so blocking that is important, but there's another hugely important part, which is just psychological. You know, it's about momentum. That if particularly both Ukrainian forces, but also the Western coalition that is supporting Ukraine, if they see major advances and feel like this is, basically people want to back a winner, And so in particularly in the U.S., there right now, most Republicans do support funding the war, but not all do. And we're going to be entering a political season for the 2024 campaigns that will be coming, you know, pretty soon. And so I think Ukraine realizes they need to make an obvious major victory.
Okay, so mm-hmm. how likely do you think they are to try and cut off Crimea? You know, if you had to give a rough probability.
Yeah, so I'm actually probably higher.
Year.
Yeah, so I'm higher than most people, and I was saying somewhere around 75%.
Okay,
that they cut off Crimea.
That they managed to.
Yeah, they managed to.
Oh gee whiz, this is okay. This is.
And that doesn't mean taking Crimea, but simply that they can have a straight line, that somewhere they'll have a continuous line from their territory, down yeah. to somewhere that just makes it cut off. Yeah.
So just for any, again, mm-hmm. I don't know how you're going to manage listeners versus viewers, but for any viewers, you can just sort of see this map. You've got the Dnieper River, mm-hmm. and then Ukraine holds everything to the west of that, mm-hmm. and they hold some stuff to the north of that. And the question mm-hmm. is, they can sort of cut many lines. And I think what Scott's sort of saying is that they're going to cut somewhere between the territory they currently hold and the coast to the east of the sort of the areas that connect Crimea and Ukraine. And if they can do any of that, then Crimea is only attached to Russia via yeah. The Kerch Bridge. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is already spicy. I'm enjoying. Okay.
Yeah. So. And this is interesting because you started the show with introduction saying that if I say something, basically you're likely to change to it, or like I feel with you and some other people I forecast with, if I hear their numbers, I need to have a very, very strong reason to go against them, because I'm fortunate enough to work with some very wise, good forecasters. But I've had also the experience of working with some people who are not necessarily professional forecasters, but who are experts in their specific fields and particularly related to Ukraine. And what sometimes comes up is one person will say, oh, this is extraordinarily hard. There are some realities to this in fighting, that it's much, much, much easier to defend an area than it is to take land. And mm-hmm. and so, and also Russia has had a very, very long time to build up defenses, to build up trenches and landmines and everything possible. They still have some air superiority in the areas mm-hmm. that they're protecting, and so it's a pretty formidable goal. And then I think there's also a time frame that, even though this question says until the end of the year, I think most people would say probably it would need to be accomplished by let's say late October at the latest,
yeah.
because you get into a point where the weather is going to make it not impossible, but extremely, extremely difficult.
So, and for clarity, mm-hmm. you, because we've kind of got this, because you're saying coast to coast, you're sort of saying that we're going to take the land bridge, therefore, and I can never quite remember how this works, because the land bridge is this like spit of land, this line,
right? Right, it's not that spit of land that you're looking at. You can go far to the west. If you can, I think it's like Armiansk. There's only two roads. There's only two roads that come in. There's Armiansk, and then there's another one north
this
of.
This one here.
Exactly.
North
of Jokoy or whatever.
This is the land bridge. I've always wondered whether this was the land bridge, because there's
that's just a spit that goes nowhere.
Great. Okay.
Or I guess technically there's no road on it that I know of.
Great.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
See, this is why I do this, everyone, is so I can ask these questions.
It's great having maps.
So you're 75% that that we're going to get, somewhere to the east of these two roads, and then we're going to. Okay.
Yeah, and obviously the goal would eventually be to reach those roads, and then it's an open question whether they should actually start trying to take Crimea, whether you push for some sort of, get Russia out, but have it in an autonomous zone. I don't know. Like that's another question. But I think, so there's clearly only two main roads into Crimea from the north, but they don't necessarily have to get to those roads. They can, if they cut off if they cut off basically from the Dnieper River down to Melitopol, they've cut off a large, they have to, they've cut off a section that would make it impossible for Russia to, you know, to continue to supply, even though they may have forces, even though they may have forces north of Crimea at that point, those people wouldn't be able to resupply from the east.
So that's kind of
we get into technical questions when we're forecasting, especially when we're trying to forecast with, you know, with numbers and say, you know, was, did it happen or not? So, for instance, if we count the land bridge as only those two little, I shouldn't call them two little roads, but the two roads that go directly into Crimea, then you could say, then you could technically say that if Ukraine manages to cut off the land between the Dnipro River and Melitopol, you know, on down to the coast there, that is that cutting off the land bridge to Odessa, or sorry, not to Odessa, sorry, to Crimea? And I would say, you know, yes, because you can't, even though it's not all the way to the, you know, gates of Crimea, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so people could still be mounting a defense. They could be mounting a defense all the way, you know, from Melitopol on down to Crimea, and that could take more time.
Okay, so with that in mind, how likely are they, do you think, to take, say, Melitopol? Like, I guess, like, it'd be interesting to hear a range of, like, different routes that you think they might go here.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, how likely are they to take Sevastopol? For anyone listening, that's the city in the bottom of Crimea. So, you know, if this would be, I think this would be a pretty major success to even take these two roads.
Or even one, even one, because if you get one, you can still start entering Crimea.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously better to take two, but
If they take Sevastopol, then that would be just a complete total victory.
Yeah,
well, not total victory, but it would be it would be
near. Yeah, it'd be very near.
Yeah, it would be a real embarrassment for Putin. So, how likely do you think that those two things are to have Melitopol and Sevastopol?
So Melitopol is this one is a difficult one for me because I think depending on how well Russia can defend Melitopol, I have the question. Obviously, it's good to take it. But is it something that they can circumvent? You know, because if you think about the fighting in Bakhmut, which is a smaller city, or, you know, I think a smaller city, Bakhmut was going on for a long time. And if you could simply go around, I mean, then maybe, you know, Ukraine can say, okay, we'll just leave this as a little enclave and not waste our time on that because our real goal is just to, you know, cut this line. And so, so a question like, is it really, is it essential within this year to take Melitopol? So I'd probably be more, you know, lower on Melitopol. Like I might be just, this sounds like a cop-out forecast, but 50%. Exactly. So,
So if they're not going via
Melitopol. Or it might even be a little, let's say 45%. So I think that it's like still pretty much the obvious route because even if they go east, even if they can cut off, they don't have to, Melitopol is the most direct route coming down from Dnipro. It's like a very narrow route. I mean, they can also go from like Novokakhovka on down, which would be another, that would actually be also a short route. So if they come from, Berislav, that's another route, which would.
Has the dam being blown changed much for you in your opinion?
I think the dam being blown changes my opinion only in the very short term. Because in the very short term, like there's clearly land that's now soaked, you know, that's not, that would be difficult to go through. But I haven't looked at this enough to say in 2 months, will whatever area was flooded with the dam, basically the water will have receded and it's now an area that people can cross, you know, without issues. One thing that's changed is it also means that, as far as I understand, Crimea is going to have a bigger problem with water, you know, to Crimea. And that's a major issue. And I also think there's a challenge for this for Ukraine because Ukraine, I think, ideally would like to take all of Crimea. But the people in Crimea, at least up until recently, viewed themselves more as Crimean than as Ukrainian or as Russian. But even by now, a lot of people who were probably more pro-Ukrainian may have left. And there are a lot of Russians there. So if, not just soldiers, so if Crimea has a very tough siege, like that's affecting the general public, is the public going to turn against, will it make the public more turn against Ukraine and see them as the oppressor? You know, so I think, it's always hard to fight an insurgency. So if It's one thing to say, okay, we know that there's Russians in Sevastopol, they have their Black Sea port and all this stuff. But if, like, you know, for instance, Sevastopol, if the city itself is opposed, you know, becomes opposed to Ukrainians, you could have a much, much tougher time. And they also have to think about after, they actually have to think about after the war. You know, if the war ends, have you so turned to people against you that, yeah, maybe you got this land, but it's a Pyrrhic, you know, victory.
So conditional on the land bridge, I mean, how if we get the land bridge this year or you know, if we're sort of attaching these two, how likely do you think we are to get Sevastopol this year?
I think Sevastopol is very low. And I'm probably going to say like 23%. 20%. And the reason for this, like, I think a lot of military people would say there's no chance. Like, I should say almost no chance. Because Crimea is very heavily defended. As I mentioned, there's only two obvious routes into it. There's only two roads. So, and it's not just like there's two roads, but there's vast wide fields that you could use to circumvent the roads. It's like, it's really two very skinny areas to go through, which is ideal for a defender. It's also, Russia will consider it extremely, extremely critical to their success, but not just their success in terms of the war, but I think they're like beyond Ukraine, because for them, Crimea has a sub base, which is not so easy to replace. It's one of two ports in the Black Sea for their Navy. There is another port, but it's their major one. And so for them, this is not quite, it's not really an existential threat, because obviously if Crimea is taken, Russia still exists as a country. But it's potentially existential for Putin and his government. You know, it's hard to say, but that would be, you know, an utter failure. Putin has staked a lot of his credibility on Crimea. Building the bridge was a major, you know, success, or, you know, something that he took a lot of pride in. You know, he's personally been there during the war. So those are things that make it difficult, besides just the straight military portion of it. So military people said this would be really hard. Ukraine doesn't have really a navy. They don't have a navy. And so, you know, if you could use a navy, then there are all sorts of ways to attack Crimea, but they don't have that. Russia's navy has been pretty well kept in port, because when they've had ships sunk, and they'll probably continue to have ships sunk. So, but why do I say like 20%, you know, not 21%, not, you know, not like near zero or 50. Sometimes when an army starts to, you know, to lose, they get routed and morale goes so low that people essentially, there's a chance that they fully give up, or that there's always a chance that domestic politics in Russia will topple Putin and somebody else takes over, and they may be more hardline. They may push the war even further. They may go for a full, you know, like call it a full war. But there's another chance that they'll just say, you know, like this was a mistake, and let's try to cut our losses and save some of our forces for, you know, later, as opposed to, you know, lose all of our military, not all, but most of their military in Ukraine. And that's why it's hard for me to say that, like, it's zero in Sevastopol.
Okay. So I guess, like, let's just pause. So one thing that I've really been struggling to understand, and I have not heard good answers for, is a kind of twofold thing, is like what's going on with the Air Force.
Yeah.
And I guess it's something that the Navy you've already explained, but it just seems like worth pointing out. So for anybody that isn't following close, can you explain why this is a confusing question that people have? And also if you have any answers to it.
Yeah. So the Air Force, the Ukrainian Air Force was basically using the same planes that the Russian Air Force uses. They're using Sukhois and MiGs, and they have planes that are roughly the same generation. They're planes that were used up until the end of the Soviet Union. Russia sometimes claims that they have very advanced modern planes that are supposed to be equivalent to our fifth generation F-22s and F-35s, but in reality, they only have something like maybe a dozen prototypes. You know, they don't really have anything to compete with very modern Western planes. So currently, you know, Russia and Ukraine are kind of similar in their, roughly similar in their abilities, although Russia probably has better avionics. But so there's a push for Ukraine to get Western planes, and currently the idea is that they are being trained on F-16s, and F-16s are also a relatively old plane. I don't remember the exact time they first went into service, but for sure they were in service by the 1980s. But they have certain advantages over the Russian planes. So first of all, they can fire Western-made missiles. They can use mm-hmm. Western-made anti-aircraft systems. They have better, and they can also be updated. So you can have a plane that went into service in 1987 that's got radars from 2005 or something. So they may be more advanced than what their original date sounds. Mm-hmm. But because they can use basically almost any Western missile system. That gives them another big advantage. And so even like air-to-air missiles, so the ability to shoot down Russian planes and helicopters, it's also easier to... There's already air defense systems in Ukraine have been used. There's systems like Patriot and Gepard and all these different systems to shoot down missiles, long-range missiles and drones. But it's sometimes harder to see those from the ground than it is from the air. Just a simple thing that ground terrain can block lines of sight and all this stuff. And so it's an advantage to be flying. It also gives you longer range. So for instance, you could take the same sort of missile that can be launched from the ground, but if it's launched from the ground, it actually has to get up into the air, gain speed, and then go wherever it's going to go. If it's dropped from a plane that's flying at 45,000 feet or whatever this is, 15,000 meters, and releases its missile at, over Mach 1 or close to Mach 2, it's going to have a lot of energy just from the platform it's being launched from, and so you have longer distances. It's also, I think, easier to see if they can get close to whatever they're going to hit. They can certainly have better visibility. There's already satellites and things like this that will show where stationary things are that Russia has. But if you get very far from the front lines, it would probably be more difficult to know to target. Target what you want to target. And so Ukraine has already given Storm Shadow missiles, which are mm-hmm. good to be launched from F-16s. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they'll ever bring in F-18s, which have some other advantages to land on rougher runways and things like that. There's a incredibly, incredibly large supply of F-16s that the West has. So in the initial phases here, a lot of the planes, so Ukraine was receiving planes from friendly countries in the area that had Soviet era planes. So they gave them MiGs and things that the pilots already yeah. pretty much knew how to fly. And that they were easy for them to, take over using. F-16s, originally they said something like, it'll take 18 months to train people on them, to train Ukrainian pilots. So that's not true at all. So that's like the amount of time that the US or NATO forces would spend when they take somebody from zero to training them to fly and be combat ready. But a Ukrainian pilot who's already a fighter pilot, already has experience, they don't need that much time. And there's also a difference if you're training when you know you're going to be going to battle immediately. I mean, I'm not saying that, obviously, NATO pilots are already very motivated. They're sort of top of the military. But it's different than if I'm literally going to be, flying to defend my country the moment I, reach reach qualification. Yeah. And they're going to, probably spend longer hours. Like, just simply the motivation's much higher. And they may, I don't know if they'll do this, but I would assume you may not also need them to learn every single thing to get them optimal. Like, if you're doing strategy, it might be like, is it better to get a pilot to perfection, or do you get them I'm just making up a number, but 95% of the way to perfection, and say better that by September, August or September, they're already engaging in the war.
So I guess the question behind this question is if Russia, his, I'm not vouching for this, but it seems about right. Russia has far, far more aircraft than Ukraine.
Right.
And yet they aren't currently dominating. I mean, do you have any thoughts? I mean, this has been surprising to me, and has been a thing I don't really understand, is why they just haven't been able to, just overwhelm, take air superiority, and then just make it much more difficult for the troops on the ground.
Well, there's a few things that come into play. One of them is they may not want to lose a lot of airplanes because airplanes, if they get very far into Ukraine actually has pretty good air defenses against airplanes. And one of the things that was interesting in this is the Soviet Union, or which is now Russia, but the Soviet Union invested very heavily into ground-based air defenses because they figured that the West was going to, you know, potentially, you know, strike them. Whereas something like the U.S. didn't really need to worry too much about the homeland being attacked by planes. I mean, like, that's just straight out ridiculous. I shouldn't say that after 9/11, but let's say with fighter jets, yeah, pretty straight out ridiculous. And so we put more energy into developing our own planes and systems to do air-to-air combat, but not so much ground-based things. So so the Ukrainians have S-300 systems, which are anti-aircraft, anti-missile systems, you know, from the Soviet times, but they're pretty effective at shooting down planes. They've been given more systems from the West. But also, when you see a number, sometimes these numbers are very misleading because you have the question like, how many of these planes are actually flight ready, you know, combat ready?
And just for anyone listening, the numbers that were on, I just found a statistic, and it sort of said 4,000 Russian planes to sort of 300 Ukrainian planes. But you're saying that number may be quite a gross exaggeration of actual force.
But also, if you keep that up for a minute, the fighter jets, it was saying 773, I think probably before the war, but it said 773 fighter jets. So when you say 4,100 planes, that's only, still a lot, but 773 fighter jets. Your transport planes matter, but transport planes aren't going to be going close to the front lines. They have 1,500 helicopters. Helicopters definitely matter, but they're also an easier target from the ground.
It's just easier to defend than attack, really. Do you think that flips around then? If Ukraine develops a lot more planes, it's not going to be as beneficial to them as one might imagine, because they will still
one of the things that depends on this is heat. There's missiles designed to take out radar installations, and so normally, if the U.S. is fighting in the first day or two of any war that the U.S. is involved in, they send in our most advanced planes and that do ground strikes to take out any sort of radar installation. And what happens is, even if you have like an anti-missile system, they can't work without turning on radar. And so the moment they turn on radar, it's easy to identify where they are and then hit them. You know, there are missiles designed to hone in on radar and take them out. And we did this in Iraq, between the two Iraq wars. We had a northern and southern no-fly zone, and any time Iraq would decide to turn on a radar, that would get destroyed. You know, if Ukraine has enough planes and enough trained pilots and enough missiles to basically be able to take out any anti-aircraft system, you know, radar-based anti-aircraft system that that Russia has within the theater of war, then Russia really has to think, do we want to turn these things on? Because if they're getting, you know, destroyed regularly, like, is it worth it?
Your contention is that Russia lacks these kinds of missiles, which is why they haven't been able to do that to Ukraine.
They have some of the missiles, but the problem is that both countries have decent anti-missile systems. Ukraine does have, their air force is very small compared to Russia's, but they do have an air force, and their air force is quite likely being given a lot of help by the West, you know, in terms of AWACS. AWACS is a early warning. This is not on any hard evidence, but the U.S. has flown, the U.S. or NATO has flown reconnaissance planes in the area, not over Ukraine, as far as I know, not officially, maybe not at all, but they've certainly flown near the borders of Ukraine with is it MQ-9 or RQ-9? Reapers, so they send like actually large drones, but even like AWACS planes that can be anywhere near can track a lot of stuff going on in the sky, and that information could be fed to Ukraine. So it's pretty hard for Russia to go in unnoticed. And so they had a lot of planes shot down early in the war, so they never managed to get air superiority really beyond the front lines.
Okay, right. I think it might be good to sort of do a bit of a lightning round on some of these other questions.
Sure.
Then,
And we don't know, with F-16s, will that give, part of it is like how many F-16s are they going to get? And I've heard ranges, like I basically heard that it will take roughly 4 months to train up pilots. That started officially, that probably started something like a month and a half ago. I don't remember exactly. I don't have that off the top of my head. But I've also heard some people say, no, they were being trained before it was announced. I don't know that either. So it could be if they were being, you know, covertly trained, they may be ready, you know, in a few months. It may be maximum sort of end of the summer by the time they would be ready to start flying F-16s. I don't know. And I also don't even know. And I've heard numbers of something like 30, but they may be many more than that. I don't know. We really haven't yet seen how many planes they can put up in the sky. And if the West will keep supplying more planes at a rapid rate, and how many Ukrainian pilots they'll have to man the planes. And it's not just the pilots, it's a whole system of training ground crews, maintenance, you know, it's a whole supply chain, but
okay, has to be in place. So with that in mind, how likely do you think they are to take Luhansk this year?
Yeah, Luhansk and Donetsk, I find, well, we're just asking about Luhansk, but I find those, I'm lower on those. So I'm probably going to be at something like 35%. And I really don't like that. That's an area I have a challenge with this. I might even say like 30% with Luhansk. Not even that may be high. One of the problems there is that gets into a region that's not necessarily very pro-Ukrainian. And so I know that Ukraine, of course, wants to push Russia back to the original Ukrainian boundaries that, you know, recognized by the United Nations, that Russia recognized when Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons. But I think that last little bit may be very, very difficult to get. And it also may be difficult to hold if the people there are not fully on Ukrainian side, or at least just say, you know, forget it, I'm happy the war is over, you know, you took the land, okay, maybe I want to be on the Russian side or at least have some autonomy. I don't know, but I think that last little bit of the far east of Ukraine will be difficult. And I also, you know, it would certainly be a victory if they take it. But as far as keeping the West on board, I don't even know if the amount of energy that would be spent on trying to take it would make it worth it, even from a political perspective, because both Zelensky, who's the president of Ukraine, and Zeluzhny, who's his top general, they realize that part of the war is simply keeping the West on, you know, on team. And yeah. So if they score big victories, that the West goes like, wow, this is something major, we're really happy, then even some of the naysayers might be like, okay, yeah, we might as well keep going with this. It's hard to speak against success. And so I think Luhansk would be, you know, much more difficult than Bakhmut, and it would be is it worth it at this point? At this point, meaning through this summer.
So Donetsk, you think, I don't know, point Donetsk would be, as well?
Probably a little bit easier. So maybe I'd say 0.25 on Luhansk and 0.3 on Donetsk or something like that. It's, you know, Donetsk is a bit further west, a little bit more space between it and Russia. Another question is just simply as you get close to the Russian borders, because Luhansk is quite close to the Russian border, would their soldiers start fighting harder? And it's simply easier to supply. It's easier for Russia to supply their troops into Luhansk and Donetsk. There's another issue that we've had. There's been these attacks from Russian fighters in Ukraine that are anti-Putin, or that have been attacking Belgorod in this region. And they're not a huge force, but they've shown that it's possible to attack in Russia with them and not lead up to a nuclear escalation. But those fighters are actually pretty problematic, because at least I forgot the name of the guy, but the leader of one of them is pretty much a Nazi, you know. So, and this is not just rhetoric from Putin. He was living in Germany. He was kicked out. He was originally a soccer hooligan, then became, you know, really fascist neo-Nazi. And so some of these guys, it's like, oh, I'm happy with what they're doing, but you don't really want to be aligning with them. So that's a challenge. And they're, yeah. So, yeah. So basically the Donetsk, Luhansk area is pretty problematic in a lot of ways. So,
okay, and you know, for the land bridge, is there anything? you know, is there anything that in a month's time would make you update up or down significantly on taking the land? What might that brick be?
Well, so for one thing, right now it appears to be that we're in the beginning of the counteroffensive, and Ukraine has taken apparently just a few small villages, and they've been trying to breach the defensive lines, which are, you know, including trenches, but also a lot of mined areas, and they have some. They have some Leopard tanks that have been converted. I think this was by the Finnish. I should check that out. But converted to be mine clearing, basically mine clearing tanks. To take off the, you take off the turret and basically put like a big, you know, something like a bulldozer thing on the front. There's different methods. And anyway, they get some of those. Apparently, like at least half of those have already been destroyed. And they're not the only ones that can be used. There's other, those would be called engineering equipment, but there's more that can still come through. But so far, it's been a pretty slow progress. And it may continue to be slow progress, but it appears right now that I think Ukraine has been using about 2 of their 9 divisions that have been like heavily trained and equipped. So they still have much in reserve. But if in a month, they haven't made it much further. If in a month, you know, it's like, yeah, a few more kilometers here or there, then I would consider that, you know, quite slow progress. And at that point, my numbers would go significantly down. I'm not too concerned in the next week or two, because it's common in the beginning of a counteroffensive to do, you know, basically to prod areas all along the front, find out which ones are, you know, the most likely to succeed. Obviously, they have good aerial surveillance, but there still might, like, so it might be like, okay, this one seems obvious, but how do the Russians respond to that? The Russians keep having to move forces back and forth trying to find where you're going to go. But at some point, they are obviously going to need to commit, you know. And so this is just a rough guess, but if you're saying a month out from now, I would think by a month out, they should already have more or less solidified on where they're going to make their major front attacks. And at that point, we should know if they're having success. With the only caveat being, if they're really waiting for, air superiority or something like this, and I don't think that's the case, but we really don't know when air power is going to come in, if at all, into this summer. And so if Zelensky is sitting there knowing, okay, I'm making some prodding moves, but by, you know, like let's say late July, early August, I'm going to have a bunch of planes that are going to change the dynamics. Maybe a month isn't that relevant, but I would think a month is relevant.
Does this seem about right to you? Sort of saying you're maybe 85%. There'll be significant gains by July, and then off that, then
by they're going to take by the end of July. Let's say by end of July. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if they're not, and hard to define what significant is, I always like the thing when we say, as a panel of Swift forecasters deem, that's a great cop-out. No, but seriously, it's like if you see that, it may be that they've made a massive amount of distance or taken major objectives, you know, so yeah, like, you know, you could say, okay, they went 75 kilometers, or if they managed to take a major city or some major obstacle along the route where and you see that the Russians are really retreating, you know, that would be a change. Right now, Russia still has air power. They still have helicopters and things attacking along the fronts. And so, you know, if they're driven back, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. But yeah, I would say that end of July, I hope to have a much clearer picture.
Okay, so do you think they're just going to blow up the Kerch Bridge for the hell of it? Like, imagine that they're not taking much ground. Mm-hmm. Do you think they're going to just storm shadow the Kerch Bridge? Or do you think they only try and get it in tandem with...
So I don't think it makes sense to completely take down the Kerch Bridge. I can see dropping one section. Like dropping, it has both train and... It's got both like a train route and a vehicle route. I could see... In one way, it makes sense to leave part of the bridge as an escape route, because if you have the Russian soldiers in, basically stuck in Crimea with no escape route other than by boat, which would probably be hit pretty easy. And obviously, the bridge can be hit easy, too. But essentially, you know, like if they're more or less getting routed and say, OK, you know, we'll allow you an escape route as part of a pause. that may be better than, you know, losing another 30,000 people in or more in a battle because they're cornered. You know, that would be a reason for not destroying the Kerch Bridge. I actually, this is you know, sort of oddball thinking, but I could see the Kerch Bridge being blown if the Ukrainians aren't having much success. You know, so it's like if they don't yeah. have much success and it's nearing the end of summer and things are really bogged down, and yeah, just go ahead and drop it, and then that's like a big symbolic victory, and it would make it hard for Russia to you know, to supply Crimea, but it would also be a big black eye for you know, for Putin. And so yeah, so I actually see it more likely in that scenario.
Okay, interesting. So let's try and
Or if Crimea is like either Crimea is seriously being defeated, and they feel like it's, you know, it's worth doing.
So yeah, if let's just try and take those. So if they're not making much ground, so the sort of in mm-hmm. the one minus case here, and they haven't. What do you think the chance of getting the Kerch Bridge is that?
By what time?
By the end of the year.
Okay. Let's see, if they're not making much progress, maybe 35%.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think even if they're not making much progress, it would certainly be a big symbolic victory, but it would still create the problem of like making the people in Crimea really hunker down and know it's you know, desperate. The other thing is it would also, if you completely drop the Kerch Bridge, it may make it very hard, especially if they've got a land bridge more or less blocked to Crimea. If the people in Crimea end up in a siege situation like the siege of Stalingrad, you're not really going to win a lot of hearts and minds among the Crimean population for after the war.
Hmm.
And I don't know how much that's going into the calculations of the Ukrainians, but I think it should be.
And if they take the land bridge, what chance do you think of taking the Kerch Bridge? So if they've already got the land bridge.
Mm-hmm. I think if they've got the land bridge but haven't made it very far into Crimea, I think it's pretty low that they would completely drop the Kerch Bridge, you know, both the train and so I'd say something once maybe 25%, just rough wide bars, but 25%.
Great. Okay, yeah. Interesting. So you're sort of saying entirely.
But if they take the land bridge to Crimea and have big success, so if they're like really routing the Russians in Crimea, then
if they take Sevastopol, right?
Yeah, if they take Sevastopol, then I would be much higher on blowing the land bridge, because I don't think that Ukraine, if Ukraine manages to. To liberate or recapture, whatever you want to call it, Crimea completely, I don't think they want a land bridge to Russia anytime soon. I mean, there may be some point 20 or 30 years from now and everything's in peace and different governments. But in the short term, I don't think they want an easy route for Russia to come back. So I would think they'd be likely to drop it if they, they took Sevastopol.
If they take Sevastopol, how likely are they to take the Kerch?
Like 65%, something like that.
And
these are just mad guesses, but yeah.
Yeah,
we have no base rate. So
I think what Scott's doing here, like I think these should be taken sort of seriously, but not, I mean, let's not take them in the. I think over the course of this podcast, we're going to have a lot of people saying a lot of things, and
And I fully accept people saying, you know, that's crazy, there's no way, or you know, he should be higher. And even like right now, David Petraeus, who I would have a lot of respect for as a military general, said, you know, he's like very, very confident that Ukraine will secure a land bridge, I think even by the end of this summer. But there's plenty of other, you know, very bright people who are like, you know, this is going to be hard slog, and they're, you know, they're a whole lot lower. And I don't think we can, you know, I think General Hodges also thinks it's quite likely that that Ukraine will take it. But it's also hard to say how much when those people are speaking, I'm not... are they also doing some sort of psychological warfare? You know, like, are they literally trying to push a narrative? Because if, like, I know, like, both Ben Hodges and General Hodges and General Petraeus, they both clearly want Ukraine to win. And so they know if they're saying, oh, it's going to be pretty gloomy summer, things are going to be bad, that's not going to help encourage the West to supply and get behind them. So it's sometimes hard, even if it's just happening subconsciously, with people, how they forecast.
Absolutely.
And as professional forecasters, we're obviously scored on our forecasts, and we're not pundits. So, if I say something and I turn out to be pretty off, it affects my whatever my score, my reputation. But I even know for myself in this particular war, I have to fight my own biases because I think we didn't mention this, but I live in Romania. I live not that far. When I say not that far, I'm probably like a 6-hour drive from Ukraine. I was just in Moldova last week, Republic of Moldova and Chisinau. So like this is close for me. I see the refugees. I've briefly been into Ukraine since the war started, but in Lviv, which is on the far west. And so I clearly have, personally taken a side. And normally, as a forecaster, it's better if you can just be, completely neutral. And so I have to try to, temper my, what I want to happen and what I, believe with what's, possibly reality. And I've talked with some professionals, people who were in pretty high levels in dealing with Ukraine and from different governments that are either like, Ukraine's just going to take everything because they're tough fighters and they're, it's their own land and they're going to fight to the last drop of blood and they're just going to, they're going to fully take the whole country, to those who are, who are more reserved. But when I hear somebody saying like, yeah, they're like just definitely going to take everything, I'm like, no, that's, I think that's a little bit over optimistic. I mean, I hope they're right, but I don't know at which point, I don't think that's something we can say with certainty.
So then just sort of two final questions. How likely are you to think that Putin will still be in power by the end of the year? And how likely that we're still fighting this war in June of next year? And if you want the Putin one, you can have an option for if they don't take Sevastopol, and if they do, if you think that.
If I just say without thinking of anything, without giving any conditional, if I just say how likely is Putin to be in power at the end of the year, I would probably give something like 77%.
Okay, interesting.
Which I actually consider pretty low. And maybe I'll say 80. Let me just change that one to 80. But and that is low, and I think one of the reasons I'm that low is usually things like this, we usually won't have much of an indication that he's about to go until he's gone.
Sure.
Because it's like, obviously we have things like Prigozhin is speaking a lot against him, the head of the Wagner group. There are some rumblings against him, but there's still, a pretty major portion of essentially the military, the security apparatus that, probably they may be under threat if he's gone. And he's set up very well not to be overthrown. He's been wise enough to not get people, move people around enough, not basically like also not let anyone, rise up too much in power. So, so I think that's a challenge. If Sevastopol is taken, I think the odds of him, being out might be down to, 65, and maybe it should be lower, but I'm going to go 65 for now. One of the questions that I basically had is there's a general opinion that if the Crimean War is lost, or certainly if that even means that, the Ukrainian invasion is lost, but even if it's just losing Crimea, that Putin is done, that he'll be dead. And I don't even think that's a guarantee. And once again, it's hard to say, but looking at the history of Russia, leaders have survived failures. Khrushchev was, Khrushchev was, let to retire. Gorbachev retired. Yeltsin retired. All of them had their own failings, and they were allowed to, live to an old age. And sometimes even, it may be that they just would end up doing a straight coup and kill him or send him to another country. But another issue can come into place, which is sometimes it's easier to force somebody out and not put the entire administration under threat, you know, because mm-hmm. even like we had questions, this is off the subject, but like in the election with Erdogan in Turkey, Erdogan won it. But we're like, okay, if he had lost, would they have tried to actually, you know, put him on trial? And it's like, well, he still has enough supporters that trying to really go hard against a recent leader can cause disruption because there may be enough people inside that just go like, okay, this puts us under threat. And the new power coming in might be like, okay, we need to take it easy. So like when Putin rose to power, he rose to power under the condition that he didn't go after Yeltsin and his entourage. Like that was basically the deal. You know, you can come in, but let us, you know, live out our days. And so I don't think it's a guarantee even that if you know, he's losing, that he's necessarily going to die. Or be done. Mm-hmm. There's another question which you don't have. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, you go. Another question.
So another question was, will Russia use a nuke? You know, the assumption would be if they did, it'd be a small tactical nuke, which small, you know, can be a relative term. So then the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were sort of the 15 to 20 megaton range. No, sorry, not megaton. That's crazy. 50 to 20 kiloton range. And tacticals could be anywhere from sort of 1 kiloton up to, you know, up to maybe Hiroshima size. And that's obviously still huge. That still would cause a lot of damage, but it would still be relatively localized. You know, it's like, it's not having a big it's not having a big advantage in terms of wiping out masses of troops, you know, like just simply being a tool. It's more, I think it'd be more of just sort of like a desperation move saying, do we, if they're really, really being defeated, would they consider it a last ditch effort just that hopefully the West would then pause and say, oh my God, this war is not worth it. We're not, you know, we'd like Ukraine, but just like, it's not worth World War III. So let's just stop. But the general consensus is if that happened, then the West, which is, and I don't like to say NATO because I don't think Hungary and Turkey will ever get involved, but that the basically the coalition of the willing, so US, UK, Poland, Baltics, would destroy most of the Black Sea Fleet and most of the major pieces of machinery in Ukraine, and that'd kind of be the end of it for you know, Russia in Ukraine. But they would need to leave enough stuff there that Russia would feel like they don't need to do another nuke because they need to have enough stuff remaining that they say, yeah, we need to stop now and save what we have and retreat and call it a day. But that still risks an escalatory cycle. And I looked at this question from different perspectives, like, okay, if the war just keeps going on as it is, I think the risk of this is, you know, well, less than 1%, you know, probably, you know, like if it's just sort of, you know, going a few kilometers around Bakhmut one way or the other, a few kilometers into the lines, like I don't see why Russia would consider it if things are just sort of more or less status quo, some small losses. But if they were, so I see like a few inflection points. One would be if Ukraine went very rapidly to the gates of Crimea,
which isn't they will.
Yeah. And if that goes very rapidly, would they consider it then? If they get to Sevastopol, would they consider it? Or not only consider it, would they do it? And if they took Luhansk and Donetsk, would they consider doing it? And I think the biggest issue would be if they got to Sevastopol, although possibly even just if they're making real progress going down in Crimea. And even in that, I'm probably at something like, I don't know, 3.5-4%, which is, you know, if it's happening rapidly. And that's, it's strange because this is one of those things where I'm like, it's low, but it's also extremely high. And the reason I say that is like, there's no really good way to create a base rate for what's the annual risk of a nuclear explosion, you know, as a hostile act against an adversary on their land. And we know we've worked with people like Robert de Neufville, has sort of, you know, specialized in this. And I think the general view was like it's somewhere less than 1% per year anywhere in the world. And even that's a pretty like it's a pretty tough number because we had two nukes in 1945. So does that mean the base rate is, you know, two every nearly 100 years? Do we count that as one because it's one event? And back then, there was only one country having nukes. So the U.S. wasn't, you know, considering, okay, if we do this, is there going to be retaliation? So so it's really hard to identify, you know, even in peacetime, what's the risk? You know, like a lot of wise people have thought about this, but we don't really know. And so, but clearly 3%, if I say 3% in one specific area based on one specific war, that's a very, very high, you know, number. And it's, now this is probably one of those things that, like, if Putin realizes, or whoever's in power realizes that it's completely in vain, if they, this is kind of like, normally the idea on atomic war or nuclear war was MAD, mutually assured destruction. And so it was the idea, you know, if they launch a nuke, we're going to launch a nuke and we're going to both start nuking each other until there's nobody left. And that's insane. So don't do it. And that's basically kept peace from, you know, when Russia first or Soviet Union first got nukes until now. And this would be another type of MAD, but not thinking about it in terms of existential risk about the world being destroyed. But basically, if Russia thinks, okay, even if they're losing, even if they've lost Sevastopol, even if the Kerch Strait Bridge to Crimea is destroyed, and they've pretty well lost the war, if they think blowing off this weapon, you know, is going to be, they need to think that it's going to even decrease, even in that case, it's going to decrease their chance of survival compared to doing nothing and just saying, okay, we lost, and let's see what we can deal with in terms of domestic politics. And that's why I think, you know, probably 3%, but I'm tempted to even be lower, but I don't think we can go much lower. There's other questions like if Putin gave the order, would the order be followed? You know, like, because there's enough people along the chain of command. If it's launched as a missile, would it be intercepted? Would it not work? You know, there's still other, you know, other steps. So it's not only, Putin or somebody else giving an order.
And so, as a final question then, I've just put about 90% for us to be having this fight in next year. Does that seem reasonable to you?
Yeah, I would think at least 90%.
Great. So I may
By the way, the Ukrainians and even the Poles are much more comfortable with a nuke going off on their territory than we are.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Because for them, it's like they're losing, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people anyway. And if a nuke, you know, they don't want their own people killed, but they're like, we're already losing lots of people. And so if we're not fighting because we're afraid of this, like that doesn't seem like a good scenario for them. You know, so I think they would be, obviously they don't want global nuclear war. They don't want even a mass nuclear war on their territory, but, you know, even things like after Hiroshima clearly was bad in terms of radiation, but it didn't radiate the whole country, you know, and it's bad to try to say that they're not so bad, but it's not like it means that that country is doomed or all of the people are doomed. And so people, you know, going out for several miles would have, you know, obviously in the near area, they'd all be dead, but then, you know, have severe radiation poisoning. But in some weeks, a lot of areas start becoming livable again, you know, so it's I don't say that to like say, oh yeah, let's not worry about nuclear war. It's reality. Yeah. And so for them, it's like, that's a risk that they are more willing to take, understandably, than somebody in the US or maybe even in the UK.
Yeah. You know, I think people probably generally underrate the risk of a tactical nuke. Cause I think we see a nuke as a very binary option.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems, I mean, Russian force doctrine, their war rules don't take it off the table in the way that I think most other people's do.
And then that just becomes a question of, does Russian command understand how the West views the use of a nuke? You know, if Russian, and do they believe us? So yeah. I think from what I know, we've given them, you know, pretty much a promise saying, if you use even a tactical nuke, even kind of just on some kind of empty land in Ukraine, you know, you're going to have an absolutely massive response that you're not going to want, you know, and it's not just going to be giving some planes to Ukraine. Yeah. It's going to be us flying them. We don't know if they believe that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
cause there is a, okay. For any listeners, I've been building up a sort of graphical picture of this discussion to try and get down most of the numbers that Scott said. I think I'll probably send this over to Scott as well, just to allow him to create. Does this seem like roughly right to you, the various numbers we've got in here? I'll send it over to you so you can just check over it.
Sure.
But I think the surprising stuff really came early on. I think taking the land bridge 75%, I think that's higher than most people I've heard.
Sure.
I think the Kerch Bridge maybe being more likely if they're less likely to kind of get close to it. I think that's like an interesting take that I'd not heard before. I think Putin number being lower is another one. So I think that's some good information here.
Yeah. And probably 90% is good in terms of the war being over, but I'm tempted to even go a little bit higher on that. But then again, probably 1 in 10.
So maybe 95? Yeah, probably
maybe 92. I mean, this is almost ridiculous to go 2 points on that because, ridiculous. I don't know that I have that level of granularity to say that. But but sometimes I'm just kind of like, well, it just doesn't seem quite right, and a little nudge one way or the other somehow feels better, and that's not very scientific. Most of my forecasting is that way. So we work with a lot of people who make very very good mathematical models, and they'll like list 7 different conditions, give percentages to each of those, come up with the total, and then say, because of that, I know it's now 88%. And I'm kind of heuristically doing the same thing in my head. And so both ways are valid. I'm not saying one is, better than the other or whatever. But so, yeah, sometimes it's just like, and part of that is just wars tend to go long. We also haven't fully defined what's the end of the war.
We've been very vague here.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And in a way, I would say if it's something like North and South Korea, I know that the North and South Korean war is not officially over, but I would consider, if there's an armistice, if there's a ceasefire or whatever, and there's no more fighting, for the next 50 years, other than, occasional little incursions, I would pretty well consider that war over, even though I know technically it's not. So,
There's a tricky thing. The war might still be continuing, but then later on, we might decide that it was over.
Because there are pretty much the hostilities had more or less ceased. And this is where sometimes we get into trouble, for listeners who don't, regularly do forecasting on platforms, like sometimes we get these technicalities that a question will end one way, and like you'll get scored, yes or no, but it's like, okay, that's really kind of technicality and that's not what we're going after. So, so I'd say 92 that, all major hostilities are done. So,
The only thing,
That would be more based on a political defeat in Russia, like the Russians deciding that they're going to give up, not on Ukrainian soldiers having, literally gone kilometer by kilometer, mile by mile, and taken, all objectives in battle. That would be more Russia retreating and just deciding it's done.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's possible to take all land in that period of time.
I agree. I would be shocked. So I'll give you a final option. A final option, if you want, I'll show you I'll show you my one if you want.
Yeah. Yes. Please.
This is very interesting to me, seeing as I haven't really shown Scott around my model.
Sure.
My model is like very different. And I think probably Scott knows more about this than I do. Anyway, so let's just like pick out some. So again, viewers can look around the model, and I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put both sets of models. I think they're pretty easy to navigate, and hopefully you'll find them interesting.
I'm looking up for a minute because I'm putting this onto a bigger screen so I can read it easier. This is something where, like right now, we were just doing sort of what we might call lightning rounds, so giving quick numbers. But when we're doing this professionally, what we often do is we will continue on a subject like this for days, weeks, months, depending on the project. And like I've already had discussions on this with many people. It's an area I'm pretty well versed on. But over time, just discussing within our group and with more people, my numbers will definitely change. And they would be absolutely informed by Nathan's numbers. So,
Will they push southeast or, will they push? So I'm about 70%. So I'm already lower than they'll even push in that direction. Then maybe, will they take Melitopol? I'm about 42%, which isn't wild compared to what you said. It's about, then
That's actually pretty close. Yeah.
For me, I think the main difference is, so there's like a load of stuff around the bridge here. You know, will they try and hit the bridge? I think I am just, well, until this conversation, mm-hmm. I was much more bearish that they would get to the top of Crimea. So mm-hmm. for me, I sort of thought, you know, will they get to Melitopol? Maybe like 40%. Will they get into Crimea? Will they mm-hmm. cut it off? I guess I would have considered that like sort of like 20%, 15%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then will they take the bridge would be sort mm-hmm. of like, again, 20.
So I'm curious about the land bridge, because you had a relatively, your percentage on Melitopol, I don't remember what mine was, but your percentage was like, I think something like 42%. I don't remember what you had there.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think so what I have is some sort of notion. I try to think about how much land they were going to take. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is a thing that I particularly do, I think, is that sometimes I can get kind of a bit retentive. But equally, like, sometimes I think it makes sense to make a model too complicated mm-hmm, and then bring mm-hmm. it back down. Mm-hmm. So I think this is an overly complex model. So I sort of went for like a land distance thing. I tried to think about mm-hmm. I thought, well, maybe they're going to take sort of 20 or 30 kilometers per month. Mm-hmm. And that also gave me a sort of notion, a bit like Scott had earlier, that he thinks, oh, if they don't take something by July, then he'll know he's wrong. And mm-hmm. I think that's a really important thing here, is to like have some early information that you might be wrong. Mm-hmm. So for me, that gave sort of Melitopol 40%, Mariupol 5%. Mm-hmm. You know, then there's some chance they take the bridge as a show of force, or they just get to the bridge. Then there's about 50% they try and blow up the bridge. And then there's whether the missiles hit, then it's about 35% chance to blow the bridge mm-hmm. up.
One thing I think I think it's worth doing what you're doing to look at distances and say, you know, how many kilometers a day. There's also vastly different periods of time. So for instance, you know, let's say you approach a massive defensive line where mm-hmm. and all the way from the Dnieper River down to Crimea is not evenly mined, or, you know, having the trenches and all that. So there are trench lines, there's like triple trench lines, mm-hmm. and, you know, it may take a significant amount of time to cross, you know, to get past one point. And it may be that getting half a kilometer, you know, takes 10 days. And then you're going to like be flying along for a while until you hit the next obstacle, you know? And so it's still worth thinking in terms of time, because like, I mean, you might say that, yeah, a tank can travel 50 miles an hour or something, but clearly they're not normally traveling 50 miles an hour, you know, in battle conditions, but like basically which are the choke points along the way where they're going to get bogged down and maybe not make any, you know, just get fully stopped versus where they can have pretty rapid growth. And if you look at something like in the fall, and we're not saying that the fall or winter is going to repeat, but when they took in the north, when they took Kharkiv, there was a pretty rapid collapse. You know, I should look at that, but I haven't looked at the actual number of kilometers that were lost. And there's an assumption that Russia is not likely to have that type of defeat again. You know, they, even though we like to, you know, joke and criticize Russia for doing a lot of things wrong, like they actually have, you know, learned and adapted throughout the war. But they did have pretty much a mass collapse there, you know? And so, mm-hmm. And so those are one of the reasons why I think it may be like slow going, and even why I mentioned end of July to see major progress. Like I expect some slow going to get past the first main obstacles, but if they do that, then there should be a pretty major advance forward, you know, with a very significant amount of land taken. And I don't think of land even as, it doesn't need to be you know, thousands of square kilometers. It's like it simply needs to cut a line, but that line can't be you know, 1 mile wide with being attacked by Russians on both sides. Like, you know, clearly they need to look at the geography and say, you know, like if you're going down a road, like how, what are the threats from either side? How wide out do they need to go to secure and, you know, and hold it? But it's not necessarily like you're needing to take a whole like equivalent of a state or something. So,
so I guess maybe it's kind of, you can afford to turn it into some more sort of granular outcomes of, mm-hmm. you know, maybe will they take this wall? Will they take this wall?
Yeah.
Maybe if, you know, I think this has given us, given me a much better, one of the things I hope to do is to sort of, if we have your model a bit, mm-hmm. then, you know, over time I can keep improving my model, and the next person I get on to discuss this, they can build a model, but also they can forecast, and then we can have some and we might, you know, if you want, we might try and get you back on if we have somebody else who really disagrees, to try and pull out that disagreement.
I also think there's a granularity that would be useful, which is right now we don't really know exactly which route they take. If that becomes obvious, or even we know that there's a couple most likely routes, if we looked at the whole path down and say, okay, you know, are there three or four major areas where they're likely to, you know, really get bogged down and the rest aren't? And then you could forecast each of those areas, like, you know, first of all, will they get past each of those areas? How long are they likely to be stuck on each of those areas? What equipment would they need to do it? Do they have that equipment? You know, like you could kind of get quite detailed, and that may help help it not just be sort of a more of a hunt, you know, educated hunch. So
Great. Okay, Scott, is there anything before we wrap up? Is there anything else that you think we've missed here? Anything else we haven't covered?
I think it's a good overview. Good overview.
I'm pretty pleased with that.
Mm-hmm. One thing I was thinking that I sometimes have been not in this discussion, but in some discussions when we were discussing how much should the West provide, what should be the West's, you know, role in the war. I've also thought about what are the consequences of Russia winning. You know, so in this case, we're just simply saying how far will Ukraine go, what success will they have. But for instance, we say, like, if I say if they get to Sevastopol, there's perhaps a certain risk of nuclear war. If the West didn't give them much of anything, and Ukraine lost all of what Eastern. If they lost all of Eastern Ukraine, if they, you know, like, what are points that would both, you know, would any of that make any difference at all in Chinese calculation on Taiwan? Like, would they say, oh, the West isn't very, you know, they're not willing to stick with it, they're not willing to take risks, therefore we can take more? Would countries who are non-nuclear countries say, you know, having a nuclear threat made powerful country back down, therefore it's better that we go for nukes? I don't even know the answer to that, but I think it's worth thinking, you know, very broadly to say, you know, this war can end in several different ways. It will have impacts beyond Ukraine. It'll have impacts, you know, going forward in time. And if you look, you know, broadly at each potential scenario, to the best of our knowledge, what would those be? And that should be also included in the calculation of policymakers.
Yeah, I think for anyone, I might throw in the show notes, Lawrence Friedman writes a good piece on salami slicing, on how Russia slicing sections off. And then now that same tactic is being used backwards, because now it would be a huge escalation for them to try and stop losing the chunks of territory. But I agree, if they if they lost all of it, then that would actually be an ultimate, you know, that would, you know, vindication of that strategy, and you might see it elsewhere. I guess we haven't covered, I'm not saying we will, I don't know if we will, but I think we haven't recovered, like, if they really try a sort of punching West strategy, if they really turn out this is a feint and everything is going to go to Luhansk, I think that would be a different thing. I guess, you know, Zelensky dies, you know, that throws everything. And I guess I don't mind not forecasting this because it's so hard to, but I do think into sort of next year or the year after, you know, what's this going to be like in an election year? What's this going to be like after an election year? I think if Trump wins, it feels, you know, and DeSantis also has been sort of a bit more negative on Ukraine. I think that feels like it will be quite different.
And I don't know the chances of that. I think it's quite low, but with Trump anyway. But I'm curious how much that goes into the calculations of Ukraine, and that's part of why I also think that Ukraine will take more this year. That I think if they were quite confident that it was either going to be Biden or somebody who was similarly aligned. So I think, like, Nikki Haley is also very pro supporting Ukraine. You know, so, like, they think if they thought it's going to be either one of these, then they might just do it on a timeline that was logical for them, as opposed to we need to push this because we're not really sure what's going to happen with, you know, Western support 1 or 2 years out.
Yeah, so I have this in mind. I have this, like, will Zelensky think it's now or never?
Yeah.
And I think to the extent that he thinks it's now or never, I think Crimea becomes more likely because, you know, he wants Crimea. And maybe I think you're right for the point that Crimea, like, it might be as difficult, say, as Luhansk-Donetsk, but it's just that much more impressive. You know, if you can take Crimea, then suddenly you're like, wow, this is blowing the whole thing right open.
Yeah,
whereas if you take, you know, 200 kilometers or something, or 100 kilometers in the west, sorry, in the east, then people might sort of say, okay, well, like, you know, this war could go on forever.
And if you get to the and if you get to the gates of Crimea, you've already pushed them back to where they were pre February 24th, you know, 2022, and that's going to be maybe harder to get all the way to the complete Russian frontier on the east. But who knows? I'm not. I would also consider the death of. I don't want this to happen, but the death of Zaluzhny to also be important because obviously Zelensky has been incredibly effective at. Getting support from the West, and so I think he is really, really critical. But from all that I've heard, Zaluzhny is quite a brilliant military strategist, and you know, not so easily replaceable. Though obviously there'd be, you know, teams of good people trying to help out, but like I think he is also a critical person in the war. So,
okay,
yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Scott.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, this has been the inaugural episode of Odds and Ends. And you know, if you disagree, if you're listening, hopefully I'm going to put all this in the show so it'll be easy to look at, or maybe you've been watching on YouTube. If you disagree, then by all means get in touch.
Yep.
And you know, if you disagree and you have your own model, then you can come on and you can tell us how we were wrong, which is what we like to hear more than anything else.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Scott. This has been really gracious of him in terms of his time, and he is, you know, really a great track record expert on this stuff. So that's great. And yeah, thank you so much. And I wish everybody a good time.
Thank you.